Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where good taste and bad taste, they explode, don't they? Oh, yeah. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And we're talking about four films this week.
That's right. It was Halloween weekend, and Halloween was on a Sunday when we normally record these episodes. So, Whitney, you were trick-or-treating with your son, isn't that fun?
Trick-or-treating, yeah. And trick-or-treating, it's not quite back up to what it was.
I can imagine that.
Last year, there were a lot of...
Fortunately, everyone was wearing masks.
Mostly, yeah.
Because of the Halloween.
Handily. Last year, and I did not get to participate last year, a lot of people were very creative about the way they distributed candy. Some of them used little grabber arms to reach out to kids because, you know, 6 foot distance. Yeah. Some of them had constructed like little slides or ramps that they could slide the candy down.
That's
so
cool.
The kid could hold it like at the bottom of the ramp.
Good for them. That's adorable.
Especially
if they
you know, had like an elevated porch. That was really handy.
I love how Halloween turns everybody into a hobbyist.
Yeah. You know, like, you can build something or make craft or make a decoration.
Yeah. You always get Christmas, you get that a little bit, but no other holiday do you get that. You think for Arbor Day, there'd be a lot of woodwork, but no.
Halloween in recent years has grown to this gigantic financial bonanza for a lot of financial institutions. This has been like since 2000 or so.
I
feel like it was growing a little before that, but it was never like at the enormity it is these days.
I think for the candy companies it was.
But the candy companies, yeah. Candy was always big, but you know, in terms of the parties and all of the ephemera that sort of goes along with
the decorations,
for adults.
The costumes, et cetera.
It became much, much bigger than it was in sort of within my lifetime. And this year it seems to be retracting a little bit. And
we're still coming out of a pandemic.
We're still coming out of a pandemic, and I'm wondering if it will continue to grow or if it will continue to retract. Going forward, well, it'll be interesting to see sort of the cultural presence of Halloween, because it's changed, and it could change again.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And it's a local thing, too. Like
it's
we live
not,
in L.A.
Not
and
worldwide.
Trick-or-treating isn't, like, prevalent in Los Angeles. There are neighborhoods where people trick-or-treat a lot, but we had no trick-or-treaters last year, or this year.
Well, but you live in a security building, so.
That's true, but there are kids who live in this building. You'd think they would go around, but no. Everyone just goes away somewhere else. We always have candy just in case.
Yeah,
no one ever stops by.
We did that for a while because we also live in an apartment with a door that leads directly to the outdoors, and so we waited for trick or treaters, waited, and nobody came. Yeah. So we just put all our candy in a big bowl and said, with the take one sign. Wouldn't you know it? It was empty when we got back.
Naturally.
Because the kid who lives across the hall probably just emptied the whole bowl.
My rule is this: if you only get one trick or treater, they get all the candy.
There you go.
You keep like one for yourself, and then like just the rest of the. Come on, like what? It's there for the kids. If you only get one kid, good for that kid. That kid gets all the candy. That kid put in the effort. Kid deserves the candy.
We already reviewed a Halloween film. Halloween 12 was last week,
but we've still got a couple of new horror movies and a few other things as well. So this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, Paranormal Activity, Next of Kin. Yeah, that came out. Army of Thieves, a prequel to a zombie movie without really any zombies in it, which is a novelty. We've got the new film Labyrinth of Cinema, which I'm ashamed to admit I haven't had a chance to see yet. And because Halloween is technically over, Coyote Creek Christmas.
I like you had to qualify that Halloween was over when you've already reviewed Christmas films this year on this podcast.
You know, we like to think that, like, you know, if you have a Halloween-themed movie, it will come out around Halloween. If you have a Christmas-themed movie, it will come out. That's not necessarily true. Gremlins came out in June.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, a lot of movies that are, like, considered, like, seasonal films or whatever, they come out whenever the studio wants to put them out. They're not necessarily... Granted, Hallmark is very, you know, very laser targeted, but that's not necessarily the case.
There were two superhero summer action blockbusters that come to mind. Batman Returns, back in the early 90s.
Set in the dead of winter, lots of Christmas.
But that came out in mid-June. And Iron Man 3 is also set at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And I think that one came out in like May or something.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah. So, like, yeah, it's not, I think Die Hard came out in the summer as well. Like, there's a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know what? You're right. I'm not going to apologize anymore. I'm going to do a Christmas movie whenever the hell I want. Up yours.
And what is this called? Like the Coyote Jamboree? Or
no.
Okay.
It's Coyote Creek Christmas. It's a whole creek.
Full of coyotes.
You think, but that's a twist. And I'll tell you about that
later. Oh my God.
I'll tell you about that later.
Oh, I'm on pins and needles.
Yeah, but speaking of, I don't know, sharp objects, let's review Edgar Wright's first, like, full-bore horror movie. He made his feature directorial debut. Well, technically, he made a movie when he was really young called Fistful of Fingers, which is a cowboy parody, but that's never been officially released in any media. And then his first proper feature film was Shaun of the Dead, which is a zombie horror comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It holds up real good.
I like Shaun of the Dead is part of what has been called the Cornetto Trilogy.
Yeah.
Which is, he made with the same cast, even though it's all different characters. And yeah, it's all three films tend to be about...
adults growing up, basically.
Adults growing up, and specifically adults who are informed by... like the pop media of their teen years, and how they are incorporating that into their lives and how it's helping or hindering them.
Exactly, and then of course he's made a few other films as well.
He's written a few films that he has not directed.
He wrote The Adventures of Tintin.
He wrote the Tintin with Joe movie. Cornish. I think he's still a credited writer on the Ant-Man film.
I think he has at least a story credit or something.
I think it's probably a contractual thing. Like, he wrote it and worked on it for a long time.
Structurally, it's still basically the movie he came up with. But yeah, so he's started, since the end of the Cornetto trilogy, started moving into more sort of films that are less about adults growing up. And more about, just stuff, I guess.
He's been exploring the genres he likes.
He's always been doing that, but I think now he's doing it with a little less focus.
So
Baby Driver was a chase/heist/getaway movie with a rockin' soundtrack. Mm. And it's a little hollow beyond that. It's kind of cool. Like, the chase sequences are neat.
He didn't come up with good, like, characters or story in that film.
Not really, no. It's very on the surface.
It's really surfacey. But yeah, the chases are really well staged. He knows how to, stage a good chase sequence and set it to music, which I appreciate. I don't know if he's done a lot of music videos.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Well,
and he's done some really, really good ones.
He should stick to that, because Baby Driver did that really well. And earlier this year, he made his first documentary film, The Sparks Brothers.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, which, is about the band Sparks, who is enjoying a wonderful renaissance. Sparks released a film earlier this year called Annette, directed by Leos Carax. It's an opera that the band Sparks made.
Some people really love that movie. They're wrong, but they really love that movie.
You know what? It's an unusual experiment, and I appreciate its audacity, even if it didn't fully work.
I can appreciate going, huh, that's weird. Yeah. I don't think it works, but I jest, of course.
And now he is making what is ostensibly a film about nostalgia, but not really, and we'll get into that. Yeah. He's made Last Night in Soho, which is a horror film, and... Last Night in Soho is about a young fashion student. She gets into fashion school and gets to move into London. She's really excited about going to the big city.
She's played by Thomasin McKenzie, who you would probably recognize from Jojo Rabbit or... what's the movie she did with Ben Foster?
Leave No Trace.
Leave No Trace. Yeah, very talented actor.
Yeah, Leave No Trace is really good. And she's really good in this until the second half, where...
That's true for a lot
where she's perhaps pushed into acting not well anymore. She's very talented, but I think she was misdirected. Anyway, she moves to London, finding the dorm experience to be incredibly lacking. She's just completely disturbed by everything that goes on in the dorm.
She's grown up fetishizing the 1960s. She only listens to 1960s music. She's obsessed with 1960s fashion. And her grandmother...
Her grandmother... Who's played by Rita Tushingham, who is a famous British actress from the 1960s. She was in a lot of, 60s new wave films in England.
Yeah, so she's crafted within young Thomasin McKenzie a sort of a fetish for nostalgia, for an era she didn't even live in.
Yeah, and...
Which is an interesting sort of approach, and there's a lot to say about that.
She's also... Her father's out of the picture and her mother has died, and she sees the ghost of her mother in her bedroom. And this is significant. She seems to have some sort of psychic power, which is never really defined.
No one ever says, you've got the shinning, this is how magic works in this universe.
Her grandmother says, even when you have your vision. So this is something that's been happening her whole life. And her mother previously went to London and suffered some sort of unseen fate, which led to this spiral of mental illness in her mother. So this is sort of floating over her. This movie takes maybe 30 to 40 minutes to establish all of this stuff before the real action gets started.
There's a lot going on here. So Thomas and Mackenzie, she moves to the big city. The dorms suck. Within one night, she's already being like really bullied and treated like crap by all of her peers. And when the opportunity presents itself to rent a room outside of the dorm, she immediately takes it. No questions asked. And when it turns out that it's in like a small corner of Soho, which is a building which hasn't been really renovated since the 1960s, it still has many of the same fixtures, and is run by, hello, Diana Rigg, awesome. She's just like, I'll take it.
Final film, I think.
I think it is. It's definitely one of them. Diana Rigg, who's, by the way, totally bringing it.
Yeah.
Totally on point. Like, it's not like, you know, like you could see, like, you know, maybe her heart wasn't in it. Like, no. She's completely laser focused. I said that already, but like, she's just totally. She's so great.
Diana Rigg is wonderful.
Amazing actor. Just absolute champion of everything. And yes, this is Diana Rigg's last role. So I just confirmed that.
Okay.
So she moves in, and as soon as she moves in that night, she has a dream about being back in the 1960s and sharing a life/body with a young woman named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Anya Taylor-Joy is attempting to be an ingenue. She's a singer. She's a dancer. She thinks the world is going to be her oyster. She's incredibly fashionable. She is confident. She is sexually powerful and in control. She meets...
This is all over the course of several nights of dreaming. We get to see Sandy's story.
Yeah, Sandy's story and how she comes to England. She makes a name for herself, and she's like falls in with this manager played by Matt Smith from Doctor Who. And then things start going horribly, horribly bad for Sandy. And what starts off as this kind of...
Well, we get the be a star, don't you? Kind of casting couch vibe to all of this.
Yeah, and then Thomas and Mackenzie, who initially was taking a lot of inspiration and power from these dreams, starts realizing that, the nostalgia that she has for that time period is based on a superficial takeaway and not actually the full-bore exploitation of the mid-20th century, especially of women, but also that the story that she has been enjoying is turning nightmarish, and she doesn't like it, and that nightmare starts sort of creeping into her real life, when she starts seeing more and more horrifying visions, and then the movie just keeps going on like that. Mm. It's an interesting setup. There's a lot of very, very good horror movies that begin with a psychic moves into a haunted place.
Yeah,
you can start that with everything from The Shining or Don't Look Now, but this movie doesn't. Let me give it its props.
All right.
This movie is stylish as hell. Very attractive. Very attractively photographed. The costume design and production design are impeccable. It looks great. Can I say that much? I think that's fair.
This is Edgar Wright's great strength as a filmmaker. He is an incredibly stylish filmmaker. He's clearly taken a lot of cues from Sam Raimi with his sort of quick cutting.
Yeah.
In this one, he's actually a lot more restrained. I think he's trying to create a little bit more mood and atmosphere, and I think he's doing a pretty good job of it. Mm. That entire introductory sequence and the first few dream sequences are really astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Some really amazing stuff.
The way he incorporates the two lead actresses like together, where they kind of see each other in mirrors and sometimes they swap places, is all just really virtuosically filmed, and it's really exciting to watch. All of that is done incredibly well.
Yeah.
The problem is Edgar Wright doesn't know what he wants to say with this.
Yeah.
And there is... Structurally, this is sort of like a horror movie about visions and haunted places. But tonally, this is a scare film from the 1930s.
Yeah.
About the dangers of the big city. And there's a lot of themes of... Not just the dangers of the big city, but... The sin of being a fallen woman, which is something that you would see in a lot of these 1930s scare films about these young hayseeds from the middle of the country who would go out to Los Angeles or New York, typically, or just the big city in general.
And then they would be immediately exploited sexually. They'd do drugs. Then it would end with them.
Don't take drugs. Don't fall in with the wrong crowd. Don't get into sex
and
work.
And it ends with them dying or going to prison or their loved ones dying or something. And it's always basically whatever you do, if you want to survive, don't do this. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of horror movie as well. But the problem is those kind of horror movies aren't just trying to scare you with the possibility of something. They're trying to say this is what it's really like. Mm. And that's dangerous. And the problem with Last Night in Soho taking so much of, of its inspiration from that, tangibly or subconsciously, is it's the 21st century, and that's an attitude that rubs people the wrong way now. Mm. And although, yes, it is fair to say there is a ton of exploitation going on in the entertainment industry today, and it was even worse back in the 60s, I am absolutely confident, the absolute one-sided nature of this is weird and frustrating, and it ends up, and we don't want to get into the machinations of the plot because there are twists and turns. By the time the movie ends, it becomes abundantly clear that this is a one-sided movie, and it doesn't seem to actually have as much sympathy for the women in these situations as you might think. Mm-hmm. And that is weird and gross. That is very off-putting.
The sympathy starts to skew in a really, I don't want to say anything, but a really bad direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, it becomes this incredibly moralizing fable. And the first half, it actually looks like it's starting to get at something. Not something terribly deep, but this notion that Edgar Wright, who likes remaking genre films, he loves the film The Driver, hence he made Baby Driver.
He loves the past, doesn't he?
He loves the past. He's nostalgic. He is a nostalgic filmmaker. He is trying to revisit genres he liked that growing up. And there are a lot of filmmakers who do this. Sure. George Lucas does this.
Mm-hmm. Tarantino does this, obviously, yeah.
There are a lot of filmmakers who sort of work in that. I feel to a degree, Guillermo del Toro does that. I feel like he can make also like up-to-date political movies, but he's also exploring genres.
Oh, 100% he does.
Yeah, Haunted House film, giant robot film.
Sure.
And so there comes a point where maybe those filmmakers need to examine their nostalgia. Why do they have it? What are they getting out of it? Is it entirely healthy? What's good and what's bad about it? And I felt for a second that Edgar Wright was looking at what he personally likes as a filmmaker about the aesthetic of the 1960s and wanted to delve into that and reveal that it wasn't all rosy, was it?
Yeah.
I'm reminded of a scene in, what was it called, 11-22-63, the Stephen King time travel movie?
Oh, it was a miniseries.
A miniseries, yeah. There's a scene where the main character in that, he travels back in time to the 1960s and he tries to stop JFK's assassination. That's the plot. And there's a scene where he gets a 60s car and he's driving through the middle of America and it's all just like unspoiled to his eye.
Yeah, pastoral.
Yeah, all these. And he stops and he just picks an apple off a tree and he eats it. It's like, oh yes, the past really was great. And he stops to get gas. And he says, I have to use the bathroom. Excuse me, sir, where's the bathroom? And he says, well, you don't want to use that one. And he looks up and it's
it's a racist. It's only white people.
And yeah, it's been segregated. And he realizes, oh, wait.
Yeah.
No, like it all comes crashing down in that minute.
We don't talk
minute.
About
like,
that as often when we talk about how great the 60s were.
The pastoral past is an incredibly racist time. Yeah. And our
collective nostalgia for those times are often based on, hey, who was a great four?
The 1950s. The 1950s.
Are we completely ignoring women, people of color, queer people? Most people really suck.
The 1950s were great if you're straight and white, and that straight white male, and that's kind of it.
And also, don't forget in the good age demographic because. That also sucks when you're old.
There's a saying, some essayists have found this. You hear it a lot in films of the 30s and 40s, but for a young person to sort of denote their freedom, they say, well, I'm free, white, and 21.
Oh, isn't that a disgusting phrase?
That was like just a common phrase that people used back then.
I never
then.
Heard that until I was an adult. And when I heard it, I'm like, whoa, what?
Yeah, I'm free, white, and 21. I can do anything I want if I'm free, white, and 21. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a horribly racist thing to say.
So there's a lot about the past that we tend to idealize, and in order to do so, we have to overlook a lot of the sins of the past.
Exactly.
I felt like Edgar Wright was trying to do that. He was trying to criticize himself a little bit. But then he backs way the hell off from that and turns this into this weird ghost story horror movie where Thomasin McKenzie starts becoming really unhinged for reasons we don't really understand.
Here's what's frustrating about this, because I think it's a decent setup. And I think once you see how it comes together, I think the setup falls apart too. But when you're watching it, the first 45 minutes or so are pretty solid. Mm. And then you can look at it in two different ways. If you really want to try to like take the themes out of it, I think it's a really important part of the film is that the themes are poorly explored and end up falling in a direction that ruins our sympathy for characters who I think we should be sympathetic for in order for the horror to work. And I think that's a giant mistake. Mm. But even just if you just want to look at it as here, the supernatural thriller mechanics doesn't work. Mm. The thrills start focusing mostly on CGI, and not convincing CGI either. Mm. There's a lot of the second half of the movie is just Thomasin McKenzie being scared of CGI shit happening around her. And even that might be okay, but here's a big problem with this movie, and I think it keeps it from feeling threatening. Nothing is happening to her in the real world that is dangerous, other than she's starting to question her sanity, which should be more of a palpable thing, but ends up feeling more like a machination of the plot than something out of repulsion or whatever.
And even though, like, there's the mean girls at school just continue to treat her mean, so it's not like she's losing a friendship.
Yeah.
She's just starting a relationship with a young man, but that doesn't seem to be a real risk, because he's actually incredibly warm and understanding about all of this.
Yeah,
she has a new job, and her boss yells at her, but she doesn't get a threat of being fired. She's
The supernatural stuff isn't hurting her or anyone else. It's not like, oh, if you die in the dream, you die in real life. There's one point in the movie, really early on, so it's not a spoiler, but where Anya Taylor-Joy is making out with somebody, and then Thomasin McKenzie wakes up with a hickey. Hmm. And you think, okay,
from the dream.
So we're thinking, okay, so this is the mechanic here. If something bad happens to Anya Taylor-Joy, Thomasin McKenzie is going to feel it too. But they drop that immediately, and that would have been a perfect opportunity for her to feel threatened as Anya Taylor-Joy's character is more physically imperiled by the abusive situation in which she finds herself. Thomasin McKenzie would be feeling that, and that would be more like, I am not just in mental danger, I'm in physical danger. And that would really accelerate the suspense here. Instead, the suspense in the second half of this movie is mostly academic. Oh no, ghosts are here. Well, what are they doing? Well, they're scary. They're scary. Okay, that's bad. Are they hurting you? No. Are they hurting anyone you know or love? No. Are they destroying your life in some way? Mostly because of how I react to them.
Yeah.
That's not really amplifying the frights here. When the movie's like a 2-hour long supernatural thriller, that's a lot of space to fill with not a lot happening. Mm. And that's not great thriller storytelling. It ends up making the movie feel bloated and thin. Because not a lot is happening. Thematically, it's not very well explored. Even if you want to go full bore and make the scare film like the horror of it, like what if there is no good in the universe? And you can totally do that.
Yeah,
you can totally be completely nihilistic or masochistic in
that's
in
except, that's
or totally. Sadistic. Sorry, sadistic in your. But you have to know you're doing that. Mm. It has to feel like a conscious decision on the filmmaker to leave the audience with that. Here, it feels like Edgar Wright just got caught up in telling the story. And story isn't that important in horror. What matters in horror is that you connect to people on a subconscious level. And there's something in this movie that repels me on a subconscious level because there's no immediate threat that hits me on, like, you know, just a physical place.
Yeah.
The mental threat is not handled very well and is mostly academic because we know everything going on is real. So it doesn't really feel like, oh, maybe this is just her losing her sanity. And then thematically, where it should hit me, like, oh, God, I also can be a victim of nostalgia, or I also can, like, overlook horrible things and, like, oh, man, that puts me in this horrible trap. Without getting into spoilers, the way the movie ends kind of undoes that.
Mm.
It does not work. No, it's stylish. No. The soundtrack is impeccable. Oh, my God, I'm going to get that. But, like, this doesn't work. It's the only Edgar Wright film I can think of that just... even Baby Driver, which I think is really hollow, at least it's like a cool, like, superficial car chase movie.
Yeah, this one,
is just not good.
It's not... the story is not well told. It does fall apart. There's a few just wild visuals that don't really lead to much of anything. There's a climax at the end where... the Anya Taylor-Joy character and Thomasin McKenzie are sort of in this dream space.
Like, they're on a staircase. That looks awesome.
It looks awesome in a comic book sort of way, but it has no place in the movie at that particular moment.
No, it doesn't really function. I feel like Edgar Wright saw Perfect Blue and was trying to make it
do
his
something
own.
Like that. But it doesn't.
Perfect Blue is pretty much. I mean, it's brutal and needs some content warnings, but as a thriller, that is everything this movie is not.
It was compared to Hitchcock when it came out, Perfect Blue, and I think the comparison is still apt.
Yeah.
Here, the parallels that we're trying to draw between Thomas and Mackenzie and the Anya Taylor-Joy character are merely mechanical. It's just plots. Mm-hmm. They don't seem to share much in terms of character. They don't seem to be unlocking much of anything. Even the mystery is not all that interesting when we finally solve what's going on.
There's like one bit that I'll admit got me. I'm like, I didn't see that. Yeah, there's coming.
You might not see coming, but you know,
it doesn't make it better. It just makes it surprising.
not terribly interesting.
A good twist will make you reevaluate everything you've seen before and make the film maybe work a different way. It's one of the reasons why the twist at the end of The Sixth Sense is as legendary as it is, because it isn't just a good twist. It also completely changes everything that came before, and it still works. Mm. And it works on a different level. And so every time you see that movie, you appreciate it differently. Yeah. Get Out is the same way. Here, it's just like, oh, that was a red herring.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm. All right. Touché, I guess. Yeah.
No, nostalgia is incredibly powerful, and it's something that filmmakers have milked since time immemorial. Yeah. But
I feel like it could have been really relevant now, because how many people are growing up with people obsessed with the 1980s.
Yeah,
they were born in the 1980s. People were born in 1990, 2000. They're adults now, and they've been 80s nostalgia has been shoved down their throats their whole lives. They've never lived it. They don't know what it was like.
If you go back to, here's what I found curious. I grew up in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. All these films that people my age are now the filmmakers. They're the ones making the decisions and remaking all this stuff. So I recognize where the filmmakers are coming from, even if, whether or not we have the same nostalgia. You go back to the films of the 80s, that's full of 50s nostalgia.
Yes,
it's all greasers and
it's always 30 years back.
57 Chevys and stuff. Look at something like Christine.
Christine, Stand By Me. Stephen King was all over it. Peggy Sue Got Married, Back to the Future.
This is something that doesn't work for me about the new version of It, which takes place in the late 80s, because they kind of time shifted it forward.
Yeah.
In the original novel, it took place in the 50s and the 80s. They were kids in the 50s and they were adults in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it has that quality I was talking about, how Stephen King was looking back at the 1950s, picking out a lot of the things he liked, but also pointing out there was a lot of violence and bullying and abusive families going on in the 50s that we weren't talking about.
Horrible violence was everywhere in the 1950s. People were terrified all the time in the 1950s, and it was considered impolite to talk about it in public, and people were just letting it happen, and that's where a lot of the horror of the first half of It comes from.
In the new film version of them, it takes place in the 1980s, and there is almost no criticism of nostalgia for the 1980s. In fact, it just rolls in the nostalgia of the 80s. It's used as sort of a positive thing.
Yeah.
Apart from a few references to missing kids on milk cartons and how they're like covering up missing posters, this tiny element of the movie,
it
doesn't really seem to be saying anything about the era and how we overlook any kind of harm that was going on in the 1980s.
That's an excellent point, by the way, and although I really, really liked that first It movie, you're 100% right about that. In the original story, it is way more about like how that is actually, the supernatural stuff is a metaphor for what was actually going on, and in the Andy Muschietti's first It movie, it feels like, oh, the adults aren't paying attention to like the plight of children and everything like that. That feels more like Pennywise is doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels more like plot than it is theme, and that makes it a little less strong, doesn't it?
That was a criticism I had of it at the time.
I don't think it hurts the movie completely, but it's a fair criticism, yeah.
We've been going through a lot of nostalgia. I'm recognizing it just because I'm that age, and I feel like disassembling a little bit nostalgia would be good, and that's not something Last Night in Soho is at all interested in doing.
Desperate to move on from the past. The past sucks. We need to constantly remember it, talk about it, contextualize it. That's important because the past is everything we've ever been. I'm eager for people to push forward so much right now, because so much of our media is based on nostalgia. Mm. A lot of our politics is based on nostalgia. The whole Make America Great Again shit. Mm. It's just like, for very specifically this one group. And then everyone else should be way more oppressed. Like, that's what they're saying.
We need to go back, and we're actively trying to recreate the oppression of the past. Yeah,
it's like, that's when we liked it best. You fuck. You evil fuck. Anyway,
fuck you.
It's such a horrible idea. I'm sorry. I know. Whatever. You know what? Let's just move on.
Oh, we can talk about another film about nostalgia.
You want to talk about another film? Okay, well, I was going to segue into another film that was about horror, but why don't we talk about another film about nostalgia? Right. Why don't we do that instead?
I'd like to talk about Labyrinth of Cinema.
Let's do it. Didn't see this, and I'm mad.
Because Labyrinth of Cinema is one of the best films of the year, and I'm really eager to talk about it. This is the final film by Nobuhiko Obayashi, a name you might recognize if you are a fan of the 1977 cult film House, which kind of exploded in popularity when it was remastered and re-released here in the United States in 2005.
It is one of the wildest horror films ever produced. It is really strange.
Nobuhiko Obayashi was a director of TV commercials, and he directed House like it was a TV commercial. That is, a lot of wild imagery, a lot of captions on screen, a lot of really dramatic poses, really fast editing, weird, wild music, completely bizarre behavior. It's amazing. You should see House. Picture House for 3 hours. Labyrinth of Cinema is 3 hours in length. And it has that same gigantic, fast-moving energy where there's just... Everything is pouring out at you really, really fast. You're just asked to drink cup after cup of this image. The plot of Labyrinth of Cinema is these three young film buffs are going to... their names are Mario, Shigeru, and Hosuke. They're going to a little tiny movie theater in Hiroshima that is about to close. And they are celebrating the closure. They're sort of celebrating the life of this theater by having a Japanese war film marathon. And... of course, there's all these, before we even get to that, there's all these weird introductions where we get to see the filmmaker introducing the film. We get to see people dictating as to what's going on as they watch from a satellite in space where there's fish floating around through the air. And then we finally get into this theater. We see these three young men, and through a weird fluke of last action hero-like magic, they find themselves sucked into the screen, and suddenly they're living through all of these classics of Japanese war cinema. And their quest as they land there, first of all, they start arguing as, like in the movie Scream, the details of like what goes on in these types of genre films, these Japanese war movies. This happens at this point, and now we have to go here. And ultimately, they find that there's a common character running, this new imaginary character running through all of these Japanese war films, this young woman named Noriko, who's played by an actress named Rei Yoshida. And they try to... and they're trying to rescue her. She sort of fulfills different functions as they kind of move from film to film. Also, as they are going through all of these war films, they also know a lot about Japanese history. And they talk at length about how Japanese cinema, and indeed cinema in general, has been perpetuating a lot of very unhealthy views when it comes to war and violence. Films are all propaganda on a level. They all are trying to sell a point of view, aren't they?
Yes, whether it's the authors or the corporations or the countries or the parties or whatever,
What the Labyrinth of Cinema is arguing is that cinema has a lot to answer for in terms of how the public views war in particular, and how it views combat, and how in cinema we tend to depict soldiers from our own countries as bold, peerless heroes who are serving the good, and the good is the nation, when in fact there's a lot of dark, violent shit in war, because war is nothing but dark, violent shit. And the parts of history that are glossed over don't make their way into the movies. And the types, and even if we're showing biographies of certain soldiers, we tend to overlook and change a lot about their lives in order to make them into movie characters. And this is this gigantic 3-hour hyperkinetic film. There's every third shot, there's a caption on the screen. So, and people are constantly yelling dialogue and giving you backstory. So your eyes are just going cross trying to, you know, pick up all these different captions and listen to all of the dialogue. And, you know, I'm watching it with subtitles, so I have to read all of this. And it's all kind of whisking you up into this gigantic miasma of criticism against filmmaking in general and how irresponsibly it's been wielded throughout history.
Yeah.
And yet it's incredibly funny. Nobuhiko Obayashi is a very funny filmmaker. He's a very energetic filmmaker.
You ever see his movie, The Drifting Classroom?
No.
It's so weird to me that House got this huge boost in America and a very similarly strange horror movie, well, horror sci-fi kind of thing called The Drifting Classroom, never did. It's based on like manga series, and it's about a high school that falls into a gigantic sinkhole. It's like that movie, it's like the TV show La Brea, but it falls into an alternate like reality where that's like
it's like Land of the Lost.
It's like this, it's like Saturn from Beetlejuice. They're like surrounded by sand and shit, and they're just living in their high school, and monsters keep attacking them, but they befriend some of the monsters, and now our teacher is turned into a giant cockroach who keeps playing the piano, and it's really fucking weird. It's amazing.
He is not a subtle minimalist filmmaker.
No, he's not.
And he actually gets like some filmmakers to come in and play and comment on their work. Like they have an actor coming in, and he's a filmmaker named Ozu. So Ozu is in this movie. It's like sitting in a director's chair saying, "Yeah, these war films. Did you notice my films were all about sort of how the country fell apart after the war? Oh yes, I did notice that. Thank you, other filmmaker." So this is a bold, glorious act of criticism about Japanese cinema and cinema in general. Here in the United States, we don't tend to do that kind of criticism. We tend to present violence in a very exciting sort of way. The most popular genres tend to involve a lot of violence.
And when we do, it tends to get overlooked. I was thinking about when you were talking about that, the Scream movies. There's a line in the first Scream that I think gets used a lot, but isn't necessarily used in context, which is movies don't, I'm going to paraphrase, movies don't make killers, movies make killers more creative. I think it's Psychos, actually, is what they say. And that's the opinion of the killers in Scream. Note who this comes from. The killers think that the movies aren't to blame for violence. And then what is Scream 3 about? Okay, maybe movies aren't to blame for violence, but the movie industry sure is perpetuating it. Scream 3 is about how the movie industry has a lot to answer for, and that they have been perpetuating, in particular, misogyny and the exploitation of women in particular, and how that the movies that continue to be made by men who have a lot of power and use it to hurt people are leaking into an entire culture, aren't they? And they actually do have an impact.
This isn't so much about the industry. This is about a little bit more about the art and the way it's used.
I think they're interlinked, though. And I think when my point is that when Scream 3 tried to actually criticize a larger scale of things rather than just saying, ha-ha, isn't it funny when in slasher movies people run upstairs instead of outside, when it finally started to get into like really horrible commentary, that's when people say, "Oh, Scream 3 isn't the good one." We weren't ready for that. Is I think what was
a little too deep there. Movies, especially here in the United States, tend to celebrate violence. There's action pictures are all about heroic violence, about committing acts of heroic violence. He committed murder. It's okay. A good guy killed a bad guy. And that's okay.
Noah Schwarzenegger line from True Lies. Did you ever kill anybody? Yeah, but they were all
All bad.
Literally every single person I've killed, and I've killed a lot of people. I did a background check. They did not deserve to live. That's the road we're going on in this Hollywood movie.
Some people have bristled when I suggest that the Avengers are nothing more than a freelance military. They're led by a guy who's carrying an American flag and is named Captain America, and they gather on a battlefield. It's not even subtext.
No, they're literally like the opening of like Age of Ultron is them doing what essentially a military mission. The opening of Captain America: Civil War is them doing what is essentially a military mission. They're a military.
The Avengers are, and so this is why people have said that the Avengers films are military propaganda. They're meant to make military fighting seem really exciting. Joining the American military force makes you a superhero.
And fighting solves problems.
And that's something that is very, very prevalent in American cinema. It's very, very prevalent in all war cinema. Any nation that's making films during wartime.
It's like, oh, war is bad, but this time
it's different. Okay, and our soldiers are the good ones. And you only need look at the propaganda of another nation to see it a little bit more clearly. because you're not getting swept up in any of your own nation's jingoism.
Yeah, once you're looking at it from the perspective of, oh, that's not me, you start, well, hopefully you'd see it anyway, but, like, regardless, yeah.
Labyrinth of Cinema is a very explicitly anti-jingoistic film. It's trying to look through all of that propaganda and explain to the audience, with as many words as possible, that what they've been consuming through a whole history of cinema has been this labyrinth, and the Minotaur is violence. That there's all of this wartime violence that we have come to accept in society thanks to the way film has been selling it to us, and film has a lot to answer for. And Nobuhiko Obayashi is really incredibly critical of that. I think that's an important message to put in cinema, an important criticism of cinema that we don't see in films ever, especially not here in the United States.
And on top of it all, it's fun to watch.
And yeah, and on top of it all, well, first of all, you're going to need a lot of energy. Like I said, this is a three-hour film and it doesn't stop. It is just madness all the way through, which I adore. I adore it. It's like watching It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. After a while, you're just exhausted.
Yeah.
But you realize there's still an hour and a half to go.
Thank God there's an intermission on that one.
Yeah, Mad, Mad World. It's like you need to lay on the floor with a pillow over your head for a little bit just to sort of calm yourself down. There is an intermission in this one as well, but it's played for laughs. It's like the intermission in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It's like, okay, we got to have a short intermission now. Go on to the lobby if you like. Okay, we're back.
Also, in Monty Python, it happens like 5 minutes before the end of the movie.
Yeah, and kind of and randomly too. Yeah.
Like right in the middle of like just walking across. They're walking across the bridge. Intermission, and we're back. They're just going across the bridge again.
I've projected that before, and during that scene, I bring the lights up in the house.
That's very William Castle of you. I love it.
It's intermission. Okay, get up. Go. Stretch your leg. Okay, we're back.
That's amazing.
This is like, it's like a Monty Python view of war, but it has really poignant and important things to say about war.
I think Monty Python actually does have important, like, they when they did Holy Grail, when they did Life of Brian, you can look at it now and you can see some of the mistakes that they made, but they had big ideas. They were critical.
If you look at Monty Python, the TV show and all of their films, they were also media critics.
Yeah.
They were looking at a lot of TV forms that were on British television at the time and lampooning them.
Yeah, they were trying to explode the idea of expectation and genre.
There's a sketch where there's all this like really tense sort of action news music, and it's over just like a montage of jars. Yeah. Just like empty jars. And then they cut to the studio, and Eric Idle swings around in his seat, the lights go up very dramatically, and he looks into the camera and as intensely as possible says, "Welcome to Storage Jars." And it's all about, it's just this bit about like the most mundane object you could think of, storage jars, but they're selling it like it's this really exciting action news segment.
I don't remember that one.
They're using media to criticize media, and that's what Obayashi is doing here.
He's criticizing
war films in a really important way. Please seek this out. It's in like virtual cinemas right now. You can find it online.
I was at the weed store. Because it's the 21st century, we have those now.
Like you do.
And I was getting the weeds. And the person at the store looked at my shirt and said, "Oh, is that a Haozu shirt?" And it wasn't, but it looked kind of like it. And I was like, "Oh yeah, did you know that filmmaker has a new movie out this week?" And the guy's like, "What?" And I feel like this has gone a lot under the radar. And I'm bummed that I didn't get a chance to see it. I've had such a busy couple of weeks. I had it like on my list. Please see this movie. But carving out 3 hours was difficult.
Yeah,
Nobuhiko
Obayashi died recently. He had stage 4 cancer and was directing this film while he was receiving treatments. He died in April of 2020.
I can't imagine. It's like when David Bowie made his last album and he realized he knew he was dying, and then you listen to that album and you realize how much it is about that. God, it's a good album. Well, thank God he gave us one last gift. Yeah, amazing.
One last amazing film. It really is one of the best films of 2021. Yeah.
There is no good segue between that and any other movies we have. So let's just run into the next big one.
All right.
This is the latest entry in a long-running horror franchise. This is Paranormal Activity Next of Kin. Now, the Paranormal Activity franchise is incredibly successful, in large part because it's incredibly cheap. The original Paranormal Activity...
Easy to make and effective.
The original Paranormal Activity movie was an independent film made for next to nothing. I think the Blair Witch Project cost more. And it was about a couple in a house and the young woman played by Katie Featherston or Featherstone?
Featherstone, I think was her name.
Katie Featherstone. She has, since she was a child, been haunted by some kind of supernatural presence. And her new boyfriend, or the boyfriend she's moving in with, rather, doesn't believe in that shit and decides to poke the bear. And things start going wrong, and she's like, hey, can we stop doing this, or can we call, like, an expert to deal with our supernatural problem? And he's like, no, I can fix the plumbing myself. And sure enough, the house gets flooded, except it's with demons, and then everyone dies, and it's horrible. That first Paranormal Activity movie is terrifying. That movie scared the crap out of me. I think it is incredibly effective in how understated it is. I think it's got a very simple theme about sort of how people don't listen to each other in relationships and how that creates problems that just escalate. And I think that really works well. It works because it's a little unexpected. It works because it's understated. And it was a huge, gigantic hit. So, of course, we needed to repeat that over and over again. And every single time you repeat it, the less subtle and unexpected it gets. The first one was basically... this first sequel was basically the first one all over again. Paranormal Activity 3 was kind of novel because they did the found footage gimmick, but like in the 80s. So they had to go with a bunch of VHS gimmicks. And that one's actually pretty good.
Hmm.
Pretty creepy. Works. Paranormal Activity 4 is the one where they tried to make the Microsoft Kinect scary.
That's... effective in that one scene.
It's just kind of forgettable. Like, it's not bad, but
the shtick is there's one, and that's the one I saw. I didn't see 2 or 3, but I did see 4. Yeah, and
2 is okay. 3 is very good.
All right, I saw 4, and I saw the marked ones, which I think doesn't count as 5 for some reason. No, but
I'll get into that in a second.
Yeah.
But yeah,
and 4, the Kinect, we get to see like through a black light how it works and how it sort of like casts a bunch of laser beams around the room and bounces off your body. And there's a bit where we get to see a shot where it casts all those lasers and we get to see a human shape that's not there in the lasers.
Like, I'll give them this. They put in the work and they tried to make that creepy, but we know you're selling us a Microsoft Kinect. I think the one you're thinking of, there was actually a forgotten Paranormal Activity movie, which I've never seen, called Paranormal Activity Tokyo Night, I think.
Oh,
and it was made in Japan. And it was the second Paranormal Activity movie. But I think it's only nebulously canon, and as usual, I don't even think it's had a proper release in America. Mm. Paranormal Activity 5, The Marked Ones, is considered canon, but it's also, it's noteworthy in that they tried to make it, like, about a Latino community, which is cool, and there's a lot of fun characters in it, but the more it reveals about the storyline, the more it just completely falls off the rails. It turns out there's a bunch of witches who are trying to create a supernatural army of super soldiers.
Yeah, there's like a cult that's abducting people, and they're marked, hence the title.
Yeah.
The actual mythology of this series makes no sense, and it kind of changes from film to film.
It actually, with the exception of The Marked Ones and Ghost Dimension, which adds 3D into it, you know, found footage 3D, because they created a 3D camera to capture the ghosts.
Is that really the premise?
Yes, it is.
Camera, okay.
Yeah, they created the someone like because they thought they
found
were capturing
3D footage. Okay.
Yeah, you know how it is. That movie doesn't work at all. The movie's very predictable, even it scares. But the actual main storyline of the Paranormal Activity movies, leaving the last two out of it, is actually pretty effective, and it's all about like people making a deal with a demon, and then that demon just sort of haunting this family generation after generation, and over time they interact with it more and more, and it starts taking a more active element in their lives, and it becomes kind of the story about sort of generational evil, and there's something to it actually when you just leave it focused simple, but the more they tried to build it out, the less effective it got. And that's true for most things, isn't it? Like, think about like how many people scoff when Halloween started saying like, oh yeah, no, Michael Myers was a supernatural creature created by the cult of Thorn to prevent the apocalypse. And you lost me. You made it too complicated.
In the novelization of Halloween Kills.
Oh no. What is this?
There's a very passing reference to Tommy, the who played Tommy in
Anthony Michael Hall. Anthony Michael Hall plays Paul Rudd in Halloween 6.
Yeah, the Anthony Michael Hall character, Tommy, who was a little boy in the original Halloween, has a mysterious tattoo that he's always rubbing, and it's the Cult of Thorn tattoo!
Yay! Yay! I love it. Bring it all back.
So they got it all in there.
Re-ruin it. I love how messy slasher movie franchises get.
We have nostalgia even for the shit.
I know. Paranormal Activity is a big old mixed bag of a series. Yeah. 1 and 3 are great.
Okay.
The rest of them are not great. And so
I thought 4 was okay.
It's watchable. It's two. Like, they're not like terrible movies. They're just not, they don't stick out in my mind, you know?
It was sort of done to the point where people got sick of it, but the found footage conceit is something that I kind of appreciate.
It's a neat idea.
The idea that, and they only really sort of play into the "this was found and we assembled it" angle a couple of times before they kind of abandoned that, and it just became an aesthetic after a while.
Yeah.
Apollo 18, the original Blair Witch Project, and what was Grave Encounters. Those are all about, we found this like at an abandoned site, and this is what we found. And
there are others, but
so somebody actually edited these films somewhere. Yeah.
The idea is that all the footage was captured by people filming it themselves. Mm. There's something kind of creepy about that, because A, this is like lost footage, and like we caught someone's last known photograph kind of, but in film form.
Makes it feel a little bit more immediate and real.
It's also almost like a Dogma 95 thing, where like you're creating a series of rules that filmmakers have to follow. You're not allowed to add diegetic music. You're not allowed to show anything that wouldn't have been filmed on their cameras. And that creates a unique set of challenges that a filmmaker has to choose to undertake. And if they can do it well, it's very effective. There's a lot of good found footage movies out there. I keep waiting for, like, the genre to be sort of... I mean, there's a lot of crap, don't get me wrong. One of the issues with it is that it's so easy to recreate that it's easy to do badly. But because there's a ton of, like, really cheap, not very good ones out there that people didn't really try. But if you try hard, there's a lot of really good ones.
But I appreciate that kind of Dogma aesthetic, because it moves toward, a little bit more genuine moments of panic if the actors are good, and... those wonderful moments where the camera is totally still and the night vision camera's on and we're looking at a chair and nothing's happening in the frame and we just sort of look at the chair and you are waiting for that chair to move on its own.
Yes, you are.
And you're looking at it and you're looking at it and it moves and you're scared.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
And that's great, because one of the things that a lot of horror movies struggle with is the idea that this is a world in most horror movies take place in a world where the supernatural isn't commonplace. Mm. There's a few in which they are. You know, this is a world where vampires are real and they're everywhere, like True Blood or whatever. That's a show, but you know what I mean. Usually, it's people who live their whole lives not encountering the supernatural, and then something scary happens. Mm. If all of a sudden you like looked out your window and there was a werewolf there, that would scare the living shit out of you. Yeah. If you lived in a world where werewolves were your neighbors, you'd go, "Oh, hi, Ted," and that would be fine. When a movie establishes that this is a universe in which supernatural occurrences are just, this is just what the movie's about, we're ready for it.
Yeah, we're looking for it now.
It's hard to reclaim that sense of normalcy that is then replaced by horror. And found footage is particularly good at that, because they allow themselves those long moments where you're just looking at a static frame. Mm. You're not expecting the visual language of cutting and cross-cutting. So you're getting really used to this frame. This frame becomes your normal. And then anything that breaks the reality of that frame is shocking. And there's a lot of filmmakers who've done this in other mediums as well. One of the scary shots in movie history is a shot of a hallway in The Exorcist 3.
Yeah.
Where you just get really comfortable with this shot, and then something terrible happens, and you don't know where it came from, and it's great. Another good one, another filmmaker who did this really, really well, was Lee Winnell in his remake of The Invisible Man, where he would do all of these shots where the camera just sort of lingers on nothing when someone moves out of frame.
The kitchen shot where nothing happens, or does it?
Yeah, and you're just sort of looking at it, and it's just like, is there an invisible man in this shot? I interviewed Lee Winnell, and he's like, is every single time the camera like lingers on nothing, is the invisible man there? And he was like, maybe not. Maybe. And that's the thing, you don't know. Yeah. You don't know. And so like you're getting used to this sort of visual quietude.
That movie effed me up.
That movie's great. So that movie's amazing.
Paranormal Activity 7.
Okay, so Paranormal Activity 5 and 6, I think they made money, but they kind of made the franchise just kind of less popular, and it didn't work. And so they went on ice for a few years.
So I've now seen four and seven. These are the 1, 4, 5, and 7 are the only ones I've seen in this series.
All right, I've seen them all.
Catching them as they pass by.
I've seen them all, and the idea is, okay, so we're going to reboot the franchise. Paranormal Activity Next of Kin does not connect to the mythology of the original series. It does not. It's its own thing. Not the end of the world, but just to be aware of it when you go in. If you're expecting the continued adventures of Toby the Demon, that's not in here. This is its own thing. To the extent that this doesn't even feel like a Paranormal Activity movie at all, because this is about like people making a documentary and things go bad. So it feels more Blair Witchy than anything else. But it is about a young woman who she's an orphan. She never knew her birth parents, and she goes on that 23andMe website to try to find her family.
And finds a long-lost brother.
She turns out she has a long-lost brother who, it turns out, is actually Amish. And by sheer coincidence, or is it, he happened to try 23andMe while he was on his Rumspringa, which is a ritual in a lot of Amish communities. I don't think everyone does it. But where young people are allowed the opportunity to go outside of Amish culture and try out living outside of the Amish way of living. Amish way of living is very rural. You're only allowed to use technology that's like actually mentioned in the Bible, that kind of thing. That's an oversimplification, but just in case you weren't 100% clear on it, it's people living in farms in mostly in America, and they don't interact with the modern world. Rumspringa is an opportunity for young people to choose to live the Amish lifestyle. And you spend some time outside of the Amish community. And there's a good documentary about it. What's it called again? It's called The Devil's Playground, I think.
The Devil's Playground, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really good film.
Yeah. And you can find out more about it there. So he was on his Rumspringa, and he tried 23andMe. And it turns out he has a sister. And she decides to go with her boyfriend, and they enlist a sound guy who's local to document her visiting her birth family. Her mother left her at a hospital. She looked very, very scared. We don't know what the deal is with that. Now she's going to spend some time with her weird and creepy Amish family. And it turns out they're weird and creepy.
They're Amish, but they're creepy Amish.
Yeah.
Are they cannibals? Because that's the vibe you get right away.
Oh, is that what the vibe you got?
Well, okay. And there's also, you know, some ho-hum Midsommar kind of culty stuff going on, but
it really
Midsommar took all of its cues from The Wicker Man anyway, so it's drawing from a lot of film traditions.
It feels very specifically like Midsommar because Midsommar was popular, but like this is basically city folk. I'm sorry, someone's vacuuming or something outside.
There's a leaf blower out there, yeah.
We did a little bit of a cut here because the machine kicked really close to the window. But where were we? It's basically this whole genre of we come to this sort of rural community from these urbanites' perspective, and is it scary? Are we just not used to their culture, or is something really horrible going on? And inevitably, something is really horrible going on because movies tend to take the perspective of urbanites. And this is one of the reasons why Tucker versus Dale is so clever.
Never leave the city. Also, never go to the big city. Those are the messages we're getting from the films this week.
Thanks, Hollywood. It turns out there might be some creepy stuff going on. Maybe her mother is still there. Maybe she's not. The first 2/3 of this movie are generic found footage pabulum. Just absolute middle of the road. What's for lunch? White rice and mashed potatoes. It'll fill you up, but there's nothing to that. There's a couple of jump scares that got me. I was like, someone in that window. Touche. But it's just familiar as hell. So it was directed by a filmmaker named William Eubank. William Eubank directed a film called The Signal, which is this low-budget sci-fi film about people trapped in, like, a scientific facility. And then it gets really fucking weird in the last act. He also directed this film.
I dig that movie. I think it's good.
I don't think it works, but I appreciate its audacity. He also did Underwater, starring Kristen Stewart, which starts out as a disaster movie and then gets really fucking wild in the last act. Paranormal Activity Next of Kin starts out as a very traditional found footage movie, and it gets really fucking wild in the last act. Getting there is a chore, though, because that first 2/3 is boring.
The first two-thirds is really boring. They're dropping all of these weird hints about what's going on, but we are way ahead of this movie mm-hmm. because we've seen movies before. There's not a lot of originality in terms of, like, the spooky imagery.
Yeah.
Oh no, they're sacrificing a two-headed goat. Even that's not all that shocking. And
yeah, somehow then, I forgot about that. That's not even they make that not interesting.
And then, of course, there's the inevitable scene where they still have their cameras on because they're using them from light, and they come upon the creepy hole. There's a big pit in the middle of a barn that leads like a full story down into the earth, and they have to lower themselves down on a rope. And
yeah, that's when it kicks into high gear. Because there's a lot of action, there's a lot of intensity.
There's definitely going to be something creepy down there, and a lot of death and monsters and whatever. Yeah. But
and to be fair, once it gets there, it's pretty breathless, and it picks up. And I was interested. It's stuff that doesn't work. This movie breaks one of the single cardinal rule of found footage movies, which is the footage needs to have been found, or at least capable of being found. Mm. There's like three shots in this movie which aren't filmed by a camera.
There's a scene right near the end where in the middle of a found footage sequence where it's like a lot of handshaking and a lot of people screaming right at the lens, and we're only seeing it from the camera light. And then there's a cut to something that's happening off camera. Very briefly, just like a bit of action.
Yeah, there's no camera within the movie that could have got that footage.
And then they cut back to the found footage. It's like,
how do you do that?
It's this weird stylistic whiplash. It's communicating what's happening rather than sticking with a style.
And you'd think, I can only imagine that the idea behind that sequence was we're going to blow their minds by breaking the rule that they've come to expect, this visual language. But it doesn't play like a, whoa, what an amazing reveal. It plays like you forgot to record that on a camera within the movie, and this is like a reshoot or something, maybe? Mm. There's a really fun movie that no one talks about called Wreck 3 Genesis, R-E-C. Mm. It's the second sequel to the movie Wreck, which was remade in America as Quarantine. Sorry, but the machine's still going in the background. Hopefully it's not too bad. But the first Wreck is very, very good. It's very straightforward found footage. It's one of the better found footage horror movies. I actually think the remake is pretty good, too. Wreck 3 is about zombies attacking a very large wedding, which is not bad for found footage because a lot of people are filming it, right? Mm. It's a very large wedding. It's expensive. Anyway, but there's the first act of the movie is just, it's like the Deer Hunter. You're just getting used to this wedding and all these characters. And then the zombies attack. And everyone runs away, and then some people lock themselves into a kitchen, and someone's got their camera. And someone does, and this is a line that's in a lot of found footage movies, which is, why are you still filming this? And usually they say something like, I don't know what else to do, or people deserve to know the truth, or whatever. In this movie, in Wreck 3 Genesis, someone says, why are you still filming this? And someone says, I don't know what else to do, people need to know the truth. And then someone slaps the camera out of that guy's hand, breaking it, and then the rest of the movie is not found footage.
That's hilarious.
It's really cute, and it's a fun movie. It's actually a comedy from that point on, and it's really fun. And that movie is a hoot. I hope more people see it. But anyway, that's done with purpose, though. That's done as a joke. That's done to pull the rug out from under us. This doesn't feel like it's done with purpose. This just feels like a thing they did, and they didn't think it was important. Yeah. It's like you can't really do that. You did a bad found footage, Petey.
You didn't find all your footage.
Yeah.
You had to get it.
Yeah, you had to just sort of throw that in there somewhere. It doesn't work at all. I mean, I've seen worse horror movies, but it's just, I had to struggle to keep my eyes open for parts of the first two-thirds of this movie. It's just so rote.
It's slow, it's rote, the characters aren't interesting. This takes place in an Amish community, but they're not presenting it in any kind of unusual way, and things we haven't seen in movies before. It is just, it's just dull. It's just a dull horror film, and boredom is the antithesis of being scared, isn't it? There's a few fun visuals near the end when things just start going a little crazy, but that's not enough to make up for all of the slog we had to go through at the start.
I'm completely pulling my hair out because of the leaf blower. We have to record. We can't wait a long time.
So let's hope
it's not too annoying. But anyway, so the movie is again, I've seen worse, but it has nothing to do with the rest of the Paranormal Activity movies, for better or worse. And it ends okay. Like, if you want to sit through it and get to the ending will make you go, ooh. But it's not great. No. It doesn't really work. Moving on, there is a, we had a sequel. Here's a prequel to a zombie movie.
From this year.
From this year, which I can't remember the last time I saw that shit. This is like Breaking and Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo territory. So Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead came out just like 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big, epic, all-star zombie heist film that took place in a world where zombies took over Las Vegas. Las Vegas is then walled off, but it turns, and they're going to nuke it to like eliminate the zombie infection. But before they do, someone hires a bunch of people to go in and steal a bunch of money from a vault. And that's where we meet the protagonist of this prequel.
And the director.
And the director, which I did not know about.
The character is... In this film, he's called Ludwig, even though in Army of the Dead, he's called Sebastian. Or did I mix that up?
You mixed it up. His name is Ludwig Dieter. But here we actually meet him, and he is... Oh, he has a really hard-to-pronounce name, actually.
Sebastian Schlenkt Vonert is the character's name.
Yeah. He is played by a really wonderful actor named Matthias Schweighofer. I hope I'm pronouncing that okay.
Who is a director in his own right.
Yeah. He's, and in Germany, he's an actor and director. Apparently, someone was telling me, I don't know how true this is, but I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
He's best known for comedies.
Yeah.
Over there.
This is his sixth film as a director, so he's got a career behind him.
So the idea is, this is how the safecracker from Army of the Dead became a safecracker. And we meet Dieter, and Dieter is... Dieter Ludwig, or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, Ludwig Dieter.
Whatever. We meet Dieter.
We meet Sebastian.
We meet Matthias Schweighofer. There you go. And he's got a crappy day job, but he's obsessed with lockpicking and safes. That's his expertise. That's what he does. But it's not his job for some reason.
And he makes YouTube videos about cracking safes that have zero views, which is a detail I appreciated.
Yeah.
And he also seems to have a superpower. He can, like, put his hand on a safe, and then through a special effects sequence, he kind of, like, can map out all of the locking mechanisms in his mind.
It's almost like he has, like, a very subtle form of sonar, just by touching it.
Yeah, like, he can kind of touch it and understand exactly what the lock needs to be unlocked.
So he's a preternaturally good lockpicker. Mm-hmm. He's contacted on his YouTube page. All of a sudden, he has one view and a comment. Ooh!
And a comment.
And for once, reading the comments is a good thing. Because a thief named Gwendolyn, played by Natalie Emmanuel, says, hey, you want to test your skills? And they leave him a note saying to go to a particular place in the middle of the night. He doesn't know what he's there for. Turns out, I love this concept. Turns out, you know, like you're watching a movie and there's like an underground fighting tournament or an underground dance tournament or something like that? There's an underground safe cracking tournament.
There's a bunch of safes in a circle and all of these... And this is straight out of Saturday morning cartoons. All of the safe crackers have like an outfit, a look, and a nickname.
They
and
all look like
really
they could have
confident.
Their own movie.
Yeah,
they all look like they could have their own movie or be like the star of this film. And the whole thing is they bring out a bunch of the same exact safe, and whoever is like... The first three people to crack it, they move on to the next round. And then, like, the next two people to crack it move on to that round. And our hero just breezes through this shit.
Mm.
And then they are enlisted to crack a series of uncrackable safes that are all inspired by...
Wagner's Ring Cycle.
And so they have names like the Götterdämmerung.
Well,
or that's,
the Götterdämmerung, which is the final opera in the four-opera cycle, was the safe from Army of the Dead.
Yeah, that was just the first one I could think of.
And they named it Götterdämmerung after the... What we learn is that there were... three safes made by this mad safe builder.
Well, four, actually.
Or four, excuse me, three other safes made by this mad safe builder, and they named them after the operas in the Ring Cycle. So we have Das Rheingold.
Yeah.
We have Siegfried. We have Die Walküre. And we have Götterdämmerung.
And so, like, the whole thing is, their plan is to not just steal money from these safes, because all these safes are still in circulation. They're used by some of the biggest banks in Europe. It's not to steal all the money from the safes, because anyone can steal money. The goal is to steal money from the most uncrackable safes and become, like, thievery legends.
Legends. Like, their goal... It's like Pokemon. They just they got to be the very best.
Yeah.
They want the reputation of having cracked the four Ring Cycle vaults.
So they end up... They have a small crew of there's a tech expert played by Ruby O'Fee. There's a getaway driver played by Goose Khan. And then there's Brad Cage... their tough guy, who's also handsome and dating Gwendolyn, played by Stuart Martin.
And they say right at the beginning, yes, he named himself after Brad Pitt and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, he wants to be the cool action hero guy.
And there's a moment early on when they finally gathered at their little safe house, which is a cat house. It is a house full of cats.
Now, the whole thing is that they're trying to like be under the radar, so they agreed to house sit for a cat lady because she would pay them in cash and they could be completely off the grid. Mm. And there's this amazing line of dialogue, and at this point I'm totally on board with this movie, where Gwendolyn is telling Dieter, yes, because we are paid in cash and living in this cat house, we are off the grid. And Dieter says, but we are on the cat grid. Trying to sound all cool. And it's the best, line of dialogue.
Totally earnestly.
It's the best line of dialogue this year that wasn't in the movie Psycho Gorman. Like, it's the single best. Because he's so genuine. Matthias Schweighofer, he was probably one of, if not the best parts of Army of the Dead. It's like him and Tig Notaro. Yeah. Like, the two best parts of that movie.
Everything else about that movie sucks. I hate that movie.
I thought it was perfectly watchable stupidity, but, like, it's not an amazing movie. Mm. He's funny. He's charming in a very, like, he's a dork, but you love him kind of way.
Yeah.
You respect how good he is at this, and that really helps. Like, I think it was Hitchcock who said, like, you don't need to like a character if they're really good at their job.
Yeah.
If they're really good at their job, you will respect a character, and that's all it takes to get wrapped up in their story. I also happen to like his character, but he's so good at his job, you love him.
And he's sort of like the knife of the group. Like, he's a little bit excited to be there, or everybody else is trying to play it really cool.
Yeah, and that's where he is here too. And so he's just gets sweat. He just thinks it's neat to be doing crimes.
Well, and the line of dialogue I was going to point out, and I love this bit of self awareness from the film, is they gather this like cool this cool crew of people who each have their all individual talents, and he has a line of dialogue like, oh, it's just like in the movies where we each have our own cool little individual talents, and they look at him, they say, yeah, it's just like that. Like, they're really excited to be characters in a heist movie.
That's why they're here. They're here because they've romanticized this. That's why they're doing this heist.
So they go, and there's, you know, a long, it's a pretty long film. It's over 2 hours.
You don't feel it, though. Like, it's paced really well.
It's paced really well, and... Yeah. Oh, and by the way, the zombie apocalypse is happening in the background.
Yeah, that's
it is
so weird.
Unbelievably incidental to the rest of this movie.
They throw in a couple of scenes where Dieter was, like, afraid. Because, like, that's weird and creepy, right? The zombie... Because it's happening in America. It hasn't hit Europe yet, if it ever does. But Dieter is, like, occasionally has a dream about zombies. And this feels like it's only there because of Army of the Dead. It has nothing to do with anything. It's only there because of Army of the Dead.
I wonder if there's a cut of this where they make no allusions to Army of the Dead.
It is kind of part of the plot, because the whole idea is that the world is so concerned about this zombie outbreak.
They're distracted enough that you can
pull a giant heist like this. That is kind of the plot, which is interesting. But like, if you saw this movie first, you would be so confused. It would be really weird. And it's kind of frustrating. I wish this movie did stand on its own more. Because although I liked Army of the Dead, I love this.
This is, like, it's really fun. It's light. It's dumb, but I don't care.
No, it's not trying to be, like, a hard-hitting crime movie. This is a fun caper of a high crime movie. This is like Top Copy or the Thomas Crown Affair. Heists are neat, aren't they, kind of crime movie.
And in fact, the biggest disappointment is it's about these four safes that they have to break into. And we only get to see three of them in this movie because the fourth is in the sequel.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer.
Like, no, I want to see them finish this story here. I don't want to have to go to that other movie to see it, because that's
completely
different animal.
Well, fortunately, you already saw it.
I did. And
I suspect...
But I don't like it.
I know. And I suspect... I have theories. I got so interested in the mythology of... Not the zombies. I don't give a shit about that. I got so interested in the mythology of, like, the safe designer and shit that I have theories. And I won't ruin it for you, but I have theories about how this could actually continue and then maybe Dieter's fine. And, like, I have some neat ideas.
I'm not sure if we could go back with Dieter, but we could... Maybe we could go, like, even further back in time to the mad safe builder and, like, what he meant those safes to be for.
Remind me and I'll tell you what my theory is. I don't want to... Because I couldn't tell you my theory without ruining the ending of one or both films. But I have a theory. I think it could be fun. But in any case, this is a hoot. And I was going to say, Matthias Schweighofer, fun actor. Mm. Genuinely funny, sweet, charismatic. You want to follow him. Great thing to do. And a really good director.
Yeah.
This is a big production. This is not a small film. It's not as gigantic as Army of the Dead, but it's got a lot of locations. It's got a lot of big set pieces. It's complicated. he makes it look effortless. Mm. It's paced really well. The acting is really, really fun. All the jokes land. The action sequences, what few there are exciting. I want to see more movies from this guy. I'm actually, like, wishing he'd directed Army of the Dead now. Like, he's really talented.
Because it would have been, you know, fun to watch and not as ponderous. He would have taken advantage of the Vegas locations a little bit better.
Yeah.
He's really good.
Credit where credit is due. Zack Snyder did work on the story for this. I'm not trying to take everything away from Zack Snyder. Yeah. And the screenplay was written by Shay Hatton, so there's that.
Deborah Snyder, I believe, is a producer on this one. Yeah. And look, for whatever reason, we're building out Army of the Dead.
Yeah.
There's already an Army of the Dead animated series as well.
Yeah. I think they're doing a movie called Planet of the Dead, apparently.
This strikes me as some sort of bizarre media experiment.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to take a random film. We're just going to make a film, and we're going to see if we can make a universe out of it from the ground up, whether or not there's interest.
Yeah, we don't care if you're interested. The important thing is that Netflix is giving us money.
Yeah, we're just gonna keep on doing Army of the Dead spinoffs and movies and TV series to see how big an empire we can build when there's absolutely zero interest from the public.
And I gotta tell you something, if you're gonna keep this approach where everything is a different genre, go for it.
Yeah, sure, fine.
You wanna do a prequel that's just Dave Bautista being a badass? Like before the zombie it's just a Dave Bautista action movie. Cool. I don't have to pay much to see that. I have Netflix, but like, you know, I'll see that. That sounds fun, especially if Matthias Schweighofer directs it. Like, I'm very much on board. Go for it.
I've seen the lead actress in this film, Natalie Emmanuel. I've seen her in a few films. Yeah. She was in the Furious films. She had a very small supporting role in those movies.
She was a hacker in Furious 7 and onward, yeah.
Yeah, she was in one of the Quibi films, speaking of media experiments.
Yeah.
She was in Die Hard.
She was in the Maze Runner movies. She's very talented.
She's very talented. I'm waiting for her to kind of, like, break out. She's got a lot of potential, but I think she's kind of stuck in sort of supporting roles here. This is maybe along this and Die Hard. She's sort of like as a co-lead, but I feel like she's capable of a lot more, and I'm waiting to see that from her.
This is a proper leading role. Lots of charisma, good romantic chemistry with someone who is playing an unusual character. So to make that work,
but a humane, likable character.
Oh yeah, but to make it work in a movie kind of way is something that is not necessarily easy, and I think she pulls it off really, really nicely. Rubio Fee is a scene stealer here. She's very, very funny. Yeah, I dig this movie.
It's just really enjoyable.
What a nice little bit of this is a term I don't use lightly, escapist entertainment. It has almost zero connection to anything other than itself. It is just a fun heist movie.
Yeah.
It is, the whole point is to be amusing and sexy and remind you that if you pulled a heist, it would be neat if it were really complicated. There's a gag, I don't want to ruin it, but there's a gag they pull on the first big heist, where it's a gag about how that's seen in all of the all the heist movies, where they go through a big visualization of how the heist is supposed to go, and then you see how everything goes wrong. They do a gag based on that. That is brilliant. That's a brilliant little gag, and it's just like, they know exactly what movie they're making here. Good for them. Good for them. I had a wonderful time. I'm just absolutely delighted by Army of Thieves. Although, my one big critique, it's like five people isn't an army.
Whatever.
In Army of the Dead, the dead had the army.
I'm looking over Matthias Schweighofer's filmography. Yeah. And he's been in mostly German films, but he was in an American film I've seen called Fear.com. Remember Fear.com?
He was in Fear.com? Never made it all the way through Fear.com.
Fear.com is shit.
It's
but
so bad. I've tried watching that movie three times. I've always fallen asleep. It is terrible.
He's the German guy.
There's a bit in Fear.com. Was one of those early, like, oh, the internet's coming, we better make some scary movies about how it's going to destroy us. Little did we know how accurate that would be. Fear.com is about a website called fear.com.com.
Fear.com.com.
Turns out fear.com was taken, so they had to call it fear.com.com. That tells you everything you need to know about fear.com right there. in that one little bit, you know, every single thing you need to know.
Fear.com is just concentrated idiocy. It is so stupid. And there's ghosts living on websites and stuff. This was in 2002, and Stephen Dorff was the cop who's investigating and snuff websites, because as soon as the internet became big, everyone assumed that there was just lousy with snuff websites. There are a lot of movies about snuff websites from the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. You ever see that film My Little Eye, or any film about streaming live on the internet?
I saw... Have I seen Dee Snider's Strangeland? I think it did.
I saw Strangeland. I never saw Untraceable with Diane Lane.
Yeah, that one too.
Halloween 8 was an internet scare movie.
Oh my god. Stay Alive is a video game scare movie, but it's so stupid. That's one of the stupidest movies I've ever seen in my life, is Stay Alive. Oh my god. There's a scene in that movie where Frankie Muniz, they're about to play a video game, and Frankie Muniz warms up his thumbs.
It wiggles a little bit.
Yeah, it's just like, I am ready. Soon I'll be ready to play a video game. And I'm like, has anyone in this movie ever played a video game, for God's sake?
We understand there's a TV involved and something with thumbs.
Oh god. Anyway, we need to move on. There's one more movie we're reviewing this week, and it's a Christmas movie! Yay! This is our little dessert.
Okay, tell me.
This is a dessert.
Tell me about Christmas in Coyotes.
No, it's Coyote Creek Christmas.
All right. Is there a coyote in it?
I'll get to that. Coyote Creek Christmas is the new Hallmark movie, one of many. And I was going to try to see more this week, because part of the beauty of these Hallmark movies is they come up with like three every week.
Mm.
So it turns into this big marathon, but it was Halloween. I couldn't in good conscience like not watch some horror movies. So I ended up watching like this big marathon of Vampiros Lesbos, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and then Coyote Creek Christmas. It stars Janelle Parrish as a young woman who is working in Denver as an event planner. She plans events. But every Christmas, she goes back home to the small town in Coyote Creek, where she plans events for her parents, who own an inn. And every year, they have a Christmassy kind of event. And this is where she learned about events, and that's where she does her Christmas. But what she doesn't realize is that her parents are going to spend their last Christmas at Coyote Creek.
Is it like Midsommar? They're going to jump off a cliff after this?
Yes, exactly. No. They're going to sell it because they want to retire.
Oh. That's less exciting.
That's a little less exciting than the Midsommar ending. I'll grant you that.
Do they enter the film and they're given these big bludgeons where they get to whack people who don't die when they fall off the cliff?
Yes, exactly what happens in Coyote Creek Christmas.
Look, let me have my fantasies.
Enjoy them, honestly. The place is about to be purchased by a pair of entrepreneurs, one of whom is played by Ryan Pavey. Mm. Ryan Pavey, who's got this incredible, like Jason Momoa's stand-in kind of quality. He's very big, very muscular, got a deep voice. But he always looks like he's surprised he wound up in the scene. He always looks like he's like, oh, hey, I have a son and I'm here to buy your hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you always get the impression that every sentence he says is going to end in a question. Yeah. And it's really great because he's perpetually interested. And that way we don't have to be. He's going to buy the hotel. But the parents say, listen, we don't want our daughter to know that you're going to buy the hotel until we tell her. Which will be a really long time, because that way you can get to know her and she'll feel like it's a lie. So could you please not tell her for a while so we can have a movie? And he's like, okay. And then he ends up with his child actor, played by Azrael Dahlman.
He ends up with his child actor.
Yeah, his child actor who is playing his son. And listen, I don't want to child acting is hard enough. Listen, I don't want to be mean here. The kid is not a great actor. The kid's just saying lines. He's in almost every scene, and he's not great. Mm. And I'm sure he's having fun, and maybe he gets better. Maybe this is... He's been in other things. He was in The Neighbor in the Window. He was in Debris. Mm. He's been in other stuff. So maybe he's better than this. But, like, this is not his finest hour as an actor. Anyway, they meet. And it turns out, here's the origin of Coyote Creek. A long time ago.
Coyote people.
You gonna let me tell the story?
No. Okay. No, I'm gonna interrupt with
a long time ago.
Coyote monsters.
An old man moved to this part of America. I think it's Colorado.
Was his name Burbank?
His name was Burbank. No, he moves to the small town. And no, it's not small town. It's all him, right? And one day, he gets a little present on his doorstep. It's a little nuts, maybe some leaves. And it turns out all of these presents were being brought to him by marmots. Okay. Marmots.
Like small rodent, yeah. Weasel-like rodent creatures.
Yeah. Yeah, marmots. And the reason why is because the presence of this guy has scared away all the coyotes. So now marmots live here. And the town's mascot is a marmot.
He's a werewolf. He's a werewolf. He scared off the coyotes because he is a werewolf.
But it raises the question, shouldn't this be called Marmot Creek? Isn't this, it's where marmots live. Mm. You have a marmot who's the mascot of the town. You named it after the animal you kicked out of town?
It's like having a city in Kansas called Shark's Reef or something.
Yeah, like what? You can't do that. I'm just endlessly baffled by this. So it turns out that the parents weren't going to have a big, like, Christmas party thing this year at this inn. Mm. So the daughter's like, well, we can't do that. I have to take control of everything. So she ends up putting on a massive event. And one of the first things she says, this is like 4 days before Christmas. Mm. Okay, we weren't going to have a big event, so we got to do it all at the last minute. First thing we got to do, we need to get a Christmas tree, she says as she's standing in front of a Christmas tree. And then she tells the people.
So she turns around and gets it.
No. This is in the lobby. This isn't like in the Christmas tree lot. It's already there. And then she turns around and then she's talking to people in the lobby. This is like the staff of the hotel. And she says, okay, I'm standing in front of a Christmas tree saying the one thing we don't have is a Christmas tree. Mm. I need you guys to go get the Christmas tree. They're sitting in front of a Christmas tree. And then later on she says, well, the important thing is that it's a really big Christmas tree. Mm. So then they go get a Christmas tree. And when they bring it back, they put it in front of two other Christmas trees that are the same size.
So now they have three Christmas trees.
They have three Christmas trees when all they needed was one, and they needed... Wait, what?
Clearly they needed three.
I guess they needed three Christmas trees to have.
There's something that's not being communicated here.
And I think it was to the production designers and maybe the screenwriter, because that's fucking weird. Anyway, they end up do the romance. They romance each other, and they're just like, "Hey, you want to like get together and stuff?" And he's like, "Nah, I have a son. I don't want to like ruin his life by being happy or some shit." And she's like, "That makes sense." And so then she finds out that he's gonna buy the place, and she's like, "You were gonna buy this place?" And he's like, "Yeah, I promised your parents I wouldn't because I respect them." You're a monster. I'm like, "Oh, okay, cool." And then they have a party that's like Christmas from all around the world. And they're going to have foods from traditional Christmases all around the world, mostly Europe. And
this is the premise of the Frozen short animated Christmas film.
That's a good point. And then the staff gets sad because you put all these other cultures here, but you forgot Coyote Creek culture. And I'm like, yeah, we've been doing that for like 50 years. Maybe we could.
So we have a coyote and you have to kill it. You have to kill it right here. Okay, I guess I'll get the gun. No, you have to use a rock. A really small one, too, so it takes a long time. Our tradition.
What?
It's our tradition.
It's a terrible tradition. It's just an ineffective tradition.
Coyote Creek is about not having coyotes around, so they have to sacrifice a coyote. Let me have my fantasies.
Throw this coyote into a pit full of marmots and see what happens.
And the marmots are all high on PCP. They can't be killed. That's a Christmas movie.
Anyway, they fall in love and stuff. They get them a thing. It's fine. I'm mostly just perplexed.
Is this Hallmark, by the marmot Hallmark thing. Netflix?
Hallmark proper. Okay. Not Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, where they acknowledge the existence of death. Mm. No. Hallmark, where like it's fine. Everything is fine. Nothing bad's going to happen here. Even if we make it seem like, oh, maybe this is their last Christmas because dad is dying. Nope, it's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine here. Everything's fine. Hmm. The only thing that's like even remotely edgy about this is that was one point where someone mentions the Krampus.
Okay.
That's it. It's like, oh, well, someone could be like the Krampus. Okay, cool. I'm glad we did this. Thank you for that. Oh, the other thing that's kind of cute about this, though, is they have a really, 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 really cute lesbian love story.
Oh, really? There's like...
Yeah, explicitly stated.
Non-heteronormative couple.
Explicitly stated. Okay. They're side characters, but they get a decent amount of real estate. She goes back home, and her best friend knows, like, a local guitar player who just plays at all the different venues, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's this cute moment where they meet in the street for, like, because the person's come from Denver for the first time in a while. And she's there with her friend, and they run into the guitar player. And I say, oh, hi! And then it just close up on the lesbian friend, just being all wistful and like, And then the guitar player's looking at her like, hey! And then we see them again, and there's lots of wistful glances, and you're looking at them, and they're cute, and you would die for them. You would die a million times over if it meant they would finally go out, and then they do, and it's great. So what I'm saying is 5 stars.
This is a queer side love story.
Yeah. But again, more real estate than a lot of like main Hollywood movies would give a queer side story, so good for them.
And a scene where they fling a coyote into a pit of marmots. They're high on PCP. So yeah.
That's why their neighborhood town is called Marmot Pit. That's like their rival. Marmot Pit. Shelbyville to their
welcome to Marmot Pit, Kansas. We don't take kindly around here. Yeah.
Let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. So on the critically acclaimed scale, it goes from C- to C+. C- is below average. We don't recommend it. C is average. A little bit of good, a little bit of bad. Bada bing, boom, average. C+, above average. We genuinely recommend these movies. They might even be amazing. Coyote Creek Christmas. This is on the weighted Hallmark scale.
We're grading on a curve here.
It's a very high C. If you're going for just like generic rom-com thrills and a cute lesbian side plot and a weird amount of marmots, you'll get what you wanted. So I'll give it a high C. Let's move back on to Army of Thieves.
I'm going to give it a C+. This film is just weirdly delightful.
Yeah, same here. This is actually one of the better...
It's clunky, like... it's not incredibly intelligent, but it's slick and it's stylish and it's fun. It's just a wonderful little puffball of a treat.
This feels like the kind of summer movie I want. Like, you know, this kind of like... blockbustery kind of adventure escapism, like everyone's just cool and sexy and having a great time.
Yeah, they try with films like Jungle Cruise, but the Jungle Cruise didn't really fly.
No,
one had a little bit of a sparkle to it.
Yeah, it feels like people were genuinely excited to make it, and I think that just adds a nice little element of passion. So yeah, big old C+ for me. Let's see here, Paranormal Activity, Next of Kin.
It's a C-. It's just boring. It's not offensive, but it is just dull.
Yeah, it's a high C-, because I do think if you can get to the ending, it does pick up a lot. But it breaks its own rules, and it's way too boring to get to it, and just doesn't really seem like it's worth the effort. So it's a C-. Let's see here. We've got The Labyrinth of Cinema.
The Labyrinth of Cinema is a C+. I love this movie with every fiber of my being. It's saying important things, and it's exciting and weird and exhaustingly energetic. Yeah, definitely a C+. Please, please, please watch this movie.
And then finally, Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho. This is a C-. I'm upset that it's a C- because there's clearly a lot of talent on display here. Again, it's a good-looking movie. It's got a good energy to it. The cast is solid. But the story doesn't work. The themes aren't very well explored. And it's ultimately not very scary. So I don't know what more I can do with it, honestly.
In addition to those things, I also think that it has this rather unfortunate moralizing component where it's not really... It seems to be preaching some pretty bad ideas, and I don't appreciate that. So
I can't really go into it without getting into spoiler territory, but that's what I meant by I don't think its themes are explored very well. Like, it's got an ugliness to its themes that doesn't seem to be, like, the scary point. Like, ooh, isn't this scary that people have this dark perspective? It feels like, no, it feels like you have a dark perspective, and I don't want to hang out with you right now. That kind of thing, you know? Like, it's like if this was a podcast, you would turn it off. He would be like, oh, I don't know if I want people espousing that ideology in my ears right now. Yeah.
Just to make it explicit, that's a C-.
Yeah. All right. That is it for Critically Acclaimed next week. We'll be back next week with reviews of Spencer, the new Pablo Larraín biopic starring Kristen Stewart. We're talking about probably Marvel's Eternals. Because that's a thing.
There's another Avengers film coming out.
Yeah, that's a whole thing that's happening.
It's a Chloe Zhao film. So yeah. The Chloe Zhao thing has me hopeful. I actually haven't watched it yet.
Nor I. There's a new Tom Hanks sci-fi film on Apple Plus called Finch, and probably more besides.
And Kenneth Branagh's new film. I think it's the week after.
That's the week after. Okay. Belfast is the week after. We'll get to that when we get... Because I'm looking forward to that. Yay, Kenneth Branagh's back. But that's coming up next time on Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Really appreciate it. We would love to hear from you. So feel free to follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
If you want to send us an email and talk about anything we discussed on this episode or anything else you want to hear us talk about, you can email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. That's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our snail mail address?
Yeah, send us an actual piece of physical mail. It is Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. And we've also got a soap store, me and my partner, M. Lapis Da Silva. Salt Cat Soap is on Twitter and Instagram, at Salt Cat Soap, and Facebook as well. We're currently having a post-Halloween sale, so rummage around. We've got 10% off some of our coolest items. And the holidays are coming. We're going to be revealing some new stock, some new cool soap designs later this week. Mm-hmm. So stick around, pay attention to our social media, and thank you everybody who's already bought some soaps. It means a lot to us. Reviews have been really, really great so far. And they make great stocking stuffers. So, bada bing. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's that.
That's that.
Thank you everybody for listening. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I'm sorry, what?